Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Tuesday, June 18th. We talk about healthcare needs on the Big Island. Hilo Medical Center is expanding, but what about Kona Community Hospital and West Hawaii residents? Putting off the inevitable, we take a closer look at the situation for Maui residents displaced by the wildfires. The deadline to leave the hotels was extended last week. In less than 10 days, military ships from 29 countries will converge on Hawaii to take part in the RIMPAC war games. Why a coalition of groups is pushing back, Cancel RIMPAC is set to kick off a series of events in the islands to raise awareness. And we heard from NFL player Marcus Mariota yesterday. Today we hear from one of the first Polynesian pro players, Ray Shunke, who penned a book about his experience. The conversation starts right after the latest headlines. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Just released a survey on the healthcare needs of West Hawaii, and it makes a case for a new facility. For years, the community has been talking about whether to relocate or replace Kona Community Hospital. Primary care, cardiology, and psychiatric care are said to be the community's greatest needs. A new facility could be costly, an estimated $163 million in the first phase and $490 million in the second. We talk with CEO Clayton McGann about the report's findings and what happens now.
It's one thing to say this is where a new hospital should go, but we really need to understand what the need is to actually build a hospital that will not only meet the needs of our current demands, but also those in the future. So that's really what this needs inside assessment is. It gives us a roadmap to get us to the next step, and that next step would be building an actually new hospital. We had various sites that we looked at. We started with six, and we've identified two locations that are feasible at this time. And those locations are the former Kmart location and then another undeveloped parcel in West Hawaii Business Park. Those two sites are what we're looking at.
Okay.
No decision has been made yet.
And so tell us about this needs assessment. What does it outline?
Well, what it does is it outlines a lot of the different various issues that we face in healthcare. And what was very fascinating is we found that a lot of our population on the west side is an older population, 65 plus. And nationally, those individuals utilize healthcare six times the average amount of others, right, of the younger population. So we started to really delve into that and say, okay, what's going on here? They should be utilizing healthcare, but they weren't. So does that mean that there are issues with provider shortages? Are there issues with access? So we looked at that, and we did, in fact, find that there are provider shortages here, which we've heard much about in the news. 25 total, both specialty and primary care providers, are needed on the west side to meet the current healthcare demands. We also found that there's lengthy appointment times. So this really results in unnecessary care delays. And then we started to look at, well, does out-migration really play a factor here? Do people come here transient and then leave the island and receive care somewhere else? And we did find that of the patients that we looked at, about 40% leave West Hawaii for inpatient care. And of that population, 62% leave for outpatient care. So we really started to delve into that even more and say, well, why? What's going on? Do they not have the resources they need here? Yes, that's in fact what we found. So we started to look at drive times. We started to look at, you know, is it because we are in an area where it's hard for people to get up to? It's a long drive for them. And we found that currently where the hospital is situated in Kealakekua, it is about 8,000 of the population that we actually can reach within a 15-minute time range. So we started to look at that and say, well, what if we can move that hospital to where the population center really is? how many more can we reach and really provide interventional technology to save lives? And you may understand that there's the, we call the golden hour, where really we want the majority of our population to be within 60 minutes of a hospital. So if we can move further north with a hospital, now our catchment increases and we're able to get 50%+ of that population close enough to a hospital where if something does happen, we can get them that intervention.
So you're making a case for a new facility and to meet the growing needs of that side of the island. You know, we were just over there on the Big Island doing stories over at Hilo Medical Center and the infusion of cash that the lawmakers set aside for that hospital and that community, and then the generous donation by Mark Benioff. You know, and I know he has also done considerable for healthcare on that side of the island as well.
Yes, he has. And honestly, you know, we're very excited for Hilo Hospital and all that they've received, because it really does bolster the healthcare needs for the whole community. And, you know, on our side, we really look at drive times, and it's very difficult at times to get that life-saving intervention even to Hilo. If you're to drive there, it's an hour and a half, 2 hours from our location. And then even challenging with Life Flight, with flying people over. Sometimes someone will present to our ER and they could wait for a helicopter, and sometimes they're not even available. So we really are happy that we're so focused on healthcare as a whole on the Big Island, and we're starting to see a lot of those efforts pay off. So it's a wonderful thing to see that.
What else can you tell us about this report and you know, where we need to go?
The biggest thing that we really have found is that we have to focus on providing care before it becomes an acute event. So in this report, it really suggests that we need to build up that provider base to meet the demands. And that provider base wouldn't just be for the hospital, but really focused on outpatient care, preventative care. And so in the report, it says that we really should focus on building integrated ambulatory care center as a first phase. Because of the cost to build a new hospital, it's extremely costly. So if we can start building up that provider base right now or as soon as we can, then that opens it up to where we can really have the means necessary, the talent necessary to staff and provide those interventional services at a hospital, which would be phase two.
We often hear about the need for physicians, and I know that the med school has done a number of things to try and increase our pool of doctors and nurses, you know, our healthcare workers. What else we need to do to address the need in the rural areas?
That's a great point you bring up. And, you know, before this role as the CEO here, I was the CEO of a multi-specialty clinic, and my primary role was hiring and bringing new physicians to the island. And it's extremely difficult. A lot of it is housing cost. When you look at some of the roadblocks that physicians face, it's extremely costly here. In addition, it's extremely difficult for any practice, including hospitals, to actually make the means necessary to offer competitive pay. And part and parcel to that is due to the low reimbursements that we receive. We are one of the lowest reimbursed states in the nation, yet we have one of the highest cost of living. So that makes it extremely challenging for us to do our job.
We know that the need for psychiatric services is great across the state. What's the snapshot there on the west side?
Great question. And one of the interesting findings in the needs site assessment is that we still have this, although it's old, hospital that is still available here. So let's say we build a new hospital north, we still have a wonderful facility that the report suggests can be utilized for exactly that, behavioral health, but also skilled nursing or long-term care. So these are the items that we're really contemplating and trying to build out a true system of care for the west side of the island. Currently, we are faced with what we call wait list. And this is really not a term that's used in the rest of the nation, but out here it is. So these are waitlisted patients. Because there's not enough resources, these patients typically sit in an acute bed waiting for, a long-term care facility to be able to have an open bed for them. So they're utilizing a very expensive resource when really we need more beds and more access to that lower acuity level. So that in itself, this new hospital would provide the opportunity to really open up additional beds, not just acute beds, that can really manage the population and their needs accordingly.
Anything else that you want to underscore just about the report and where Kona needs to be?
You know, we haven't secured the funding, so there's going to be a lot of effort there. And we're very excited about this opportunity, especially a big thanks and mahalo to our Westside legislators that have really championed this effort and made it possible to even get to this step. And for us, we are excited about the challenge to try to build a new hospital, and we hope to meet the needs of the community, not just for the last 100 years, but 100 more years. And that's our focus.
That was Clayton McGann, CEO of Kona Community Hospital, who sat down with us to talk about the results of a recent health needs survey for West Hawaii. There will be two public information sessions about the report, one on Monday, June 25th, at West Hawaii Civic Center, and then again on Thursday, June 27th, at Kona Community Hospital. Both meetings will start at 5:30 p.m., and we'll have links on the conversation page of our website later today.
This week's performance at HPR's Hawaii Jazz Performance Series is sold out. Mahalo for your support. Watch videos from past HPR concerts and sign up for email alerts for future performances. Visit hawaiipublicradio.org, sponsored by Farm Lovers Markets.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, with a mission to provide fresh water to the people of Oahu, committed to conserving and protecting Oahu's water resources since 1929. BoardofWaterSupply.com.
It's been a real roller coaster for families left homeless in the Maui wildfires and who are still living in hotels. There are close to 500 people who were facing an eviction deadline of June 10th, but who were granted another extension. HPR reporter Ashley Mizuo takes a look at a closer look at this situation. Good morning, Ashley.
Good morning. So, yeah, there are about 180 Maui families, which is about 490 people, who lost their homes, you know, in the fire last August, and they're still living in hotels, which is what the state's non-congregate shelter program is. And that was supposed to end, as you said, on June 10th, but got extended again till the end of the month. Originally, the hope was to have all of the families in more permanent housing by May, but the state's non-congregate task force leader, Derek Ching, says, you know, finding housing to suit the needs of each family has been really difficult.
Not all units are pet friendly, or landlords are not willing to accept pets. Some have school age children that go to school in the West Maui, and therefore being tied to a unit outside of West Maui becomes a challenge from a transportation, et cetera, issue. There are families that have specific medical requirements. Trying to get them matched to meet those medical requirements is a potential challenge.
And so, you know, people with medical conditions, they might have trouble finding units that can accommodate gurneys or wheelchairs or things like that. And then in some cases, families have gone to the unit and then discovered it to be uninhabitable.
It can run the myriad of, you know, bug infestation, you know, certain areas that could pose a tripping hazard, et cetera, et cetera. So then landlords and or FEMA would then need to do required repairs to make them habitable.
Well, that really surprises me.
Right, right. And so, you know, when they go to the home and it's not, you know, there's bugs and stuff, it's not like they want to live there. And so then it takes time for them to either remediate the situation or find additional housing to match all those same needs, but get them in there. And, you know, many of the families are going through FEMA direct leases, which can place them into housing for up to 18 months.
Yeah. And I know, you know, it's been 10 months, so it's very stressful for these families because, you know, it's just wearing them down.
Right.
But, you know, they do keep extending these deadlines.
Yeah, they just keep the reason that the state can only extend the program for a few weeks at a time. I think we've probably reported that they've extended maybe like once a month for the past couple of months. I mean, that's because they need approval from the Federal Emergency Management Agency to get that. And FEMA will only approve in 1 month increments. So that's why we keep seeing, you know, we get to the end of the month and then they extend for another month and so on and so forth. And so the reason that they need FEMA to agree is because FEMA is supposed to reimburse the state for the cost, or I think it's about 90% of the cost related to the hotel sheltering program. And, you know, Ching says most of the people who are still left in the program are eligible for reimbursement. But at one point, this reimbursement question was a huge problem because it's really costly to keep people in these hotels. You know, during the legislative session, the cost of the program was a huge contention point between the lawmakers and the administration because the state had reported it was costing about $1,000 a day per family in the hotel program. And then to put that in perspective, the program started with like 8,000 people in these hotel shelters. And so that's why the state had signed this $500 million contract with the Red Cross to provide this hotel sheltering program. And FEMA is supposed to reimburse 90% of that. But it has its limits because some households don't qualify for FEMA because they were undocumented or they were homeless before the fire. And so the state has been negotiating with FEMA to bring the number of those who are ineligible down. And that number does keep on dropping. The last one I heard was back in March, and that was about 600 ineligible families. But it's likely that that number has decreased since then. They did tell me this morning, Haima told me this morning, that they've spent about $340 million of that $500 million to operate this program. But they said that they actually have started receiving funds back from FEMA for those who were 100% eligible for the reimbursement. So they've gotten back about $250 million, they said. And that's kind of surprising because I think one of the concerns was that because Hawaii the state has to front the money, they were worried that it would take years for FEMA to do this reimbursement. So it's a good sign that they're seeing some of those funds come back already. And then starting in April, FEMA also stopped reimbursing the state for meal service for those who were staying in the hotels. The reasoning was that grocery stores in Maui had reopened, so the state no longer provides meals for the families who are living there. However, they did say that Red Cross is tracking those who are facing food insecurity in the program. But they really just don't have a definitive end date for the program. I kind of pushed them to see if, you know, what is like the absolute longest that this could go. And they kind of dodged the question. And this is what Derek Ching said.
There's a commitment by the state to care for all of those in need. So we'll find ways to care for them. I think as long as there's a justifiable need, we're going to do whatever we can to care for these families. I think that's a commitment by the governor, the administrator, and all of us.
And I've seen a report, I didn't do the reporting, but from another outlet that said October was a month that had been floated at one point. And I know during the legislative session, June was a big date because that at that time, that was as far as FEMA said that they would go to. But I think as the general consensus is that as long as FEMA continues to extend the reimbursement and they still haven't been able to place all of these families in proper housing, then they will try to keep this program open.
And is there anything that they can do to try and get people in these units quicker?
Yeah, so that's why they've been asking people who live in West Maui if they have homes that they can rent to contact the state or contact FEMA to let them know because they are trying to serve these different types of needs, as we heard in the beginning with the pets or, you know, disability issues and things like that. But also they've been kind of putting a lot more pressure on families who are living in these hotels to accept the placements that are given to them. So currently people sheltering in the hotel have two chances to accept the permanent housing or the more permanent housing. If they decline both, they have 8 days to either find their own housing or they have to start actually paying the cost themselves in the hotel. This number used to be, a few months ago, 4 chances for those who were FEMA eligible and 2 chances for those who weren't. But then Ching said that that was getting too complicated and that people would decline and wait for their final chances. So they changed it to just 2 chances for everyone. And so there have been several families that have declined their housing offers and just left the program. So they said this morning that there had been about 27 households who have done that. So they didn't accept any of the housing placements and also had to leave the hotels.
Well, so we don't know where they are, though.
Yeah, yeah. They didn't provide specifics.
Yeah, yeah. But it's hard because you're trying to figure out, well, are they just getting too picky and, you know, and don't what you want to be in you know, more stable housing for your family?
Right, but then also it's like on the other hand, too, you know, like every them extending it month by month by month, I'm sure these families are feeling that pressure or concern. And I think a lot of it also has to do with some of the families are bigger, and so the housing just, like, can't support the number of people in the families. But, yeah, so I think for those who are in the hotels who are still in the sheltering program, they've been feeling that instability and insecurity for so long. And so it's important that they're able to find the proper housing to get people in there.
Yeah, and, you know, when we were there talking to families, I know there was a situation where you had multiple people working and they were relying, you know, on, like, one car. And then, you know, if they move them further out, it's going to be just more difficult logistically to go to work.
Right, for work and then also schooling, although it is summertime, so maybe that makes things a little bit easier. Or also I could see it being a lot more difficult because there's not as much child care because they won't be going to school.
Yeah.
It's just an impossible situation for these
families. Everybody, yeah.
Yeah.
A tough situation. All right, well, thank you so much, Ashley.
Thank you.
That was HPR's Ashley Mizuo talking to us about the limbo that families who survived the Maui wildfires are in, as officials try to get them out of hotels and moved into more permanent housing. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. We are taking you to the roots of one of Hawaii's well-known pesky plants. Chances are you've heard of the kiawe tree, whose sharp thorns can grow as long as 4 inches and are known to pierce through slippers. Yes, I've had that happen. And even car tires. Despite its fierce reputation, it's also good for furniture wood and even good for a barbecue. Kiawe is a type of mesquite tree, and one of the meanings of its name in Hawaiian is to sway. It was introduced by a famous missionary in the 1800s. He brought it in as a seed from Paris's royal garden, or perhaps Chile. This Catholic priest planted a slew of trees in the churchyard of what is now Fort Street Mall. But as one story goes, none grew save for a kiawe tree. Its popularity soared with the introduction of cattle and horses, which ate the pods, and bees, which pollinated yellow kiawe flowers and yields a delicious honey. For today's backyard quiz, we want to know the name of the priest who introduced kiawe trees to Hawaii. Call 808-941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right wins a reusable HPR tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, supporting nonprofits such as the Molokai Affordable Housing Alliance, providing kupuna with resources for building affordable homes on Molokai. NareitHawaii.com.
The military intends to launch the RIMPAC 2024 war games at the end of the month. 29 countries are taking part in the military exercises. It's a regular drill, and this year, Vice Admiral John Wade will oversee the operation. He was the commander in charge of the defueling of the Red Hill underground storage tanks following a fuel spill in 2021. Wade is now head of the U.S. Third Fleet in San Diego. But in advance of RIMPAC, a coalition of groups gathered in front of the headquarters for the commander of the U.S. Pacific Fleet yesterday to call for the cancellation of the war games. We talked to Misty Pegram, who is with the group Anakbayan Hawaii, an organization that promotes national democracy in the Philippines.
The movement to cancel RIMPAC has actually been around for much longer than I have been alive. Since RIMPAC started in 1971, back then it was held annually. Then it eventually became a biennial exercise by the U.S. Pacific Command. So the coalition that is currently being built is kind of a continuation of the decades of work that has already been done by Kanakamali activists, folks who stand in solidarity against the military occupation in Hawaii. And so really the goal in this campaign to cancel RIMPAC, we see it as a manifestation of the U.S. military's want to, you know, this idea of constantly being ready for war, and where their idea of a free and open Indo-Pacific is not aligned with what a free and open Indo-Pacific actually is, which is peoples and nations who, you know, want to be able to experience genuine freedom away from militarism, away from the bombing of sacred lands, away from just the general exploitation of the land and the people that happens whenever the U.S. military has its bases in a certain area. Particularly, like, for example, with the case of women's rights, you know, we see that gender-based violence increases whenever RIMPAC is around or whenever any military exercises happen, whether that be here in Hawaii or in the Philippines or even in Okinawa and Japan. So just building up on that solidarity that folks from nations across the world are showing to cancel RIMPAC and to stand against militarism and military intervention.
Do you plan any other activities while RIMPAC is here?
Yeah, so the campaign this year is actually being supported by another international campaign, which will host a People's Summit and mobilization in San Diego at the end of this month, on June 29th to 30th, which also has different actions happening throughout the week, too. They'll also be holding a press conference up in San Diego. But for here in Hawaii, different actions are currently being planned around cancel RIMPAC. And once the details of those come out, then we'll be able to share more with you. I know for a fact right now, different organizations like the Democratic Socialists of Oahu, for example, are hosting a Bash RIMPAC Bash, which is like a night of solidarity, music, and speakers to talk about why we need to cancel RIMPAC. And that's going to be happening in Waianae at the Waianae Skate Park on June 28th. Malama Makua will be holding a reenactment of the author of like Queen Liliuokalani at Iolani Palace on July 4th. That is another event that's happening that's not directly tied or organized by the coalition, but is, you know, part of a build-up for Lahoʻiʻoiʻea, which will be happening at the end of the month of July. And so those are just some of the events that are on our radar right now. And we are currently in the process of planning events directly to answer the call to cancel RIMPAC.
And what can you tell us about some of the other groups? Because it's a cross-section of different community groups.
So some of the other organizations that have really been working towards upping the informational campaign and the education around what RIMPAC is, because we've seen that for the most part, that not a lot of people are aware that this happens every 2 years or to the extent at which it happens, like all of these different countries that are participating that people might not have known of. So some of the other organizations that are helping to organize are one, Anakbayan Hawaii, which is a Filipino youth organization, mostly based in UH Manoa, but we tackle issues of sovereignty and national democracy in the Philippines. Then there's also Jewish Voices for Peace Hawaii, their Hawaii chapter, who was the one to organize the press conference. We have organizations like the Students Protesting Against Militarism, the one I mentioned earlier, the Democratic Socialists of Oahu, organizations like the Students and Faculty for Justice in Palestine. We have Affirm Hawaii, who is another organization that has been doing a lot and recently also helped organize a panel, as well as like Kalahui Hawaii, who was also there to organize that panel. Just working with a bunch of different organizations at different capacities to put on different events and connecting, you know, all the different issues here with RIMPAC, because as a whole, really RIMPAC is the prime manifestation of imperialism and the military occupation happening in Hawaii.
That was Misty Pegram, who is part of a coalition calling for the cancellation of the RIMPAC War Games. RIMPAC 2024 starts on June 27th and will run through August 1st.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Dean Slider, author of Fear Less. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about how to live beyond fear, anxiety, anger, and addiction.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Mobi, a Hawaii wireless company since 2005, featuring a locally based customer care team committed to problem solving and personal service for each client. Learn more at mobi.com.
Now it's time to uproot the answer to our backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you about the history of the kiawe tree, a type of mesquite tree that was introduced to Hawaii way back in 1827. These trees produce thousands of seeds every year in hardy pods, which can withstand salt water and drought and can persist in soil for multiple decades. The plant is native to Africa, but it spread quickly throughout the Hawaiian Islands. And by 1965, it was estimated that there were 155,000 acres of kiawe in the state. The first kiawe tree was taken as a seed from either Paris or Chile and planted in an Oahu churchyard. In 1919, it was chopped down to make room for the Knights of Columbus building that was built on Fort Street. But its 15-foot trunk was mounted and preserved. We were looking for the name of the priest who first brought kiawe to Hawaii, and that was Alexis Bachelot, the first leader of the Sandwich Isles mission. Fun fact, Bachelot also introduced bougainvillea to Hawaii. And our winner today, drum roll please, Andrew Doan of Manoa, you got it right. But that's our quiz for today. Send your ideas to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Fat Girl Sings may seem like a peculiar title for a memoir for a pro football player, but it sets up a glimpse into the world of football and how the pressure to fit in can be intense, whether you're in a schoolyard or on the professional gridiron. 82-year-old Ray Shonky made it big with the then Washington Redskins as a lineman. He was inducted into the Polynesian Football Hall of Fame in 2015, an honor that he treasures today. He was in town recently for his Punahou class reunion and talked candidly about the culture of pro ball and the early lessons that made him stronger on and off the field.
As a young child, I was overweight, brown skin, and in Texas. And as a 10-year-old and 11 and 12, the kids would make fun of me. And they'd call me Fat Girl to humiliate me and embarrass me. I was just so saddened by it. And then when I got to junior high, I was again surrounded by boys. Now I was a little bit bigger and had a new bike and everything. And they surrounded me, and one kid came up and punched me in the face. And I went up to the principal's office, and they took everybody and got rid of the kids who were humiliating me, and said, "Raymond, you're going to have to learn how to deal with this." And I tried to figure out, what did he mean by that? So the next time they tried to do that to me, I decided to counter and punch the guy in the face. And that changed everything. That once that they realized that I could protect myself, life changed for me. The courage for me to do that. And then when I went out for football, I found out the varsity kids went after the freshmen and tried to do the same thing. And then it... it goes on in college, you know, which is even unbelievable. It goes on in the pro football, that people can be intimidated in pro football. I mean, it's the most craziest thing in the whole wide world. How can you intimidate a big 6'4", 270-pound guy, and you can intimidate him? And what I found out is you need to counter it right then and there to it with as much force as necessary, or even more force that's necessary to convince people you will not tolerate it. And that's where Fat Girl has always been with me throughout my life.
I was at a talk that you gave last week, and my jaw just dropped to learn about some of the things that were going on in pro ball and the culture that existed back then. And, you know, I want to believe that that culture doesn't exist now, you know, that we have.
I would be surprised if it doesn't exist, because you're human beings, you're people that are dealing with violence. And you're dealing with people who are trying to get a one-up on somebody. It's not equal force. It's mental ability to deal with that force and how you can counter that force with your mind versus your body. And those who can put their mind and that force together have power. And the only way you counter that power is to do the same thing. So if you're going to come at me one way, I've got to have the same thing. Now, if you have superior mental capacity over me, then you're going to win. And that's what you can't have. And once they detect that you have a weakness there, if you can be intimidated, then it changes. And it's crazy that NFL players can be intimidated. That's what's nutso. You know, I had a guy come to me who was 6'5", 280 pounds. And he said, "This guy's grabbing my face mask." He was a defensive tackle. I said, "All you have to do when he grabs your face mask, pull straight down his hands and you'll break his wrist." And he said, "I can't do that. And this is in the middle of a game." I said, "What do you mean you can't do that?" You know, it doesn't make any sense. We're in a violent business, and the guy doesn't have the capacity to break this guy's wrist while he's doing something that is illegal. And when you go to the refs, they don't see it.
Yeah, and his survival may depend on it.
Yeah, you know, and the game may depend upon it. You know, so it's like trying to convince somebody it's all right to hurt the guy, because he's doing something that is wrong. And when he's doing something that is wrong, if the refs don't see it, then you have to figure out, what am I going to do? Do I let this guy continue? Or do you make him pay a price? I made him pay a price. If they did something to me that was illegal, I said, "Hey, don't do that." And of course, you'd say, "MF," and they'll punch me in, you know, slug me with a forearm in the face. As my head locks back, I grab his face mask and jerk it up, and I just start wailing into his face. And I had pads on me with fiberglass cast underneath, which is like brass knuckles, and I left the edges open, and I'm just cutting him up and punching him, and blood's flowing. Then they break it up and offsetting penalties, and they say, "Hey, man, you want to do this every play?" And suddenly, he doesn't do it anymore.
You had to stand up for yourself.
Yeah, it's amazing, you know, what force equals force. But what's so fascinating in a business where it is violence, you know, and that's part of the game, that when the personal battles are taking place sometimes that are necessary, it's so hard for guys to do that, because they go by the rules, you know, and this guy's violating the rules, so he's expecting the official to stop it. And when the official doesn't stop it, he doesn't know what to do.
Well,
which is not so.
I have to admit, though, and it's probably my naivete about the game, but when you mentioned that you were expected to take amphetamines to get out there on the field and play the game and win, I was really stunned at that. And a friend of mine who was there talked about that football players are like gladiators. They exist for our entertainment, you know, and the price of survival out on that field in the Coliseum, you know, or on a football field was just really, it was stunning to me, that analogy.
Well, you know, when I was playing with the Dallas Cowboys, I played with them the first 2 years. We were playing in New Orleans, and it was a pre-exhibition game, and it was very, very hot. And then at halftime, when we went back, I couldn't get up. I couldn't stand up. And so, you know, they wondered what happened. So the trainer came in and said, "What's wrong, Ray?" I said, "I can't stand up." And he said, and he realized, he said, "Listen, you can't do this to me. I got to see," because his job was to make sure that we never got tired, that we took care of all the injuries. Mine was I had lost all my energy. He said, "From now on, before a game, you take this one pill And then right before the game starts, you take these three pills, and then at halftime, you take another pill. And basically, there were five uppers, and I was taking 25 milligrams for a game. Well, I did it, and this was in Dallas, Texas. It was hot as hell. And I did that, and man, I was flying. I mean, I was flying everywhere. I couldn't believe what happened, how I never got tired. But then, of course, you had to come down afterwards, and it took a long time. But it was part of the game, you know, that they would not, you could not, you know, get tired. You couldn't use that being exhausted as an excuse. And that was, you know, that was in the 60s and 70s.
They made you supermen.
Well, what it did is that what I did when I got to the Redskins, the doctor was dispensing, and I let him tell me what I could do and what I couldn't do. That it was part of the profession, you know, that the guys were taking drugs. A lot of guys took drugs and didn't sleep for days. I wanted to take enough just to get me buzzed, but I wanted to go to sleep that night. Sunday night, I was going to go to bed. I was not going to go to bed on Wednesday night. But guys who were taking heavy amounts of drugs, you know, they didn't sleep. And, of course, there were some very sad stories, you know, that happened because of that.
Well, when I think of your injuries, you know, you had a separated rib cage and you went out there and you played even though you could barely breathe. You know, you talked about the injuries of your teammates, you know, where they basically had broken bones in their hands and wouldn't let on that they were in pain because they didn't want to be targeted. And I think, gosh, we put our athletes on a pedestal. And the whole drug thing really, I don't know why it shocked me, but I guess maybe hearing it from you, directly from you. You know, because as a fan, right, when you see the stories about, you know, Mac McGuire and Barry Bonds and, you know, the steroid use and Lance Armstrong, a part of you just cringes and is so sad.
Well, yeah, the end justifies the means. I mean, it's like I have to perform, and I can't perform, but with these drugs, I can perform. And so, you know, you try to justify it, and the organization justifies it. You know, we need you out there. You know, regardless of, you know, your hands all messed up, doesn't make any difference, you know. If you can play, play hurt. And you learn to play hurt without the drugs. And then when it gets really serious where it gets to a point where you can't, and that has to be really serious because most guys, you develop this ability to play in pain. Then the drugs help to nullify it so that you can get through the game. And then after the game is coming down out of it, you know, it's a struggle.
That was Hawaii's Ray Shonky, former pro ball football player, talking frankly with us about the culture of the NFL. We will hear more right after a short break.
When you support HPR, you support community reporting about community issues.
It's been more than 8 years since a group of families from Ha'ena Kauai established the Ha'ena Community-Based Subsistence Fishing Area. The community creates rules regulating catch limits, size limits, species limits, and more.
With your support, HPR brings you voices from our island communities.
It's a tool that makes sure that we can keep on practicing and fishing the way we did, and not excluding folks, but saying like, hey, if you like come fish in this area, this is how we fish, this is how we take, this is how much we take.
It's got to be community driven, got to be from the people of the place. They know their place better than anybody.
Support local reporting on HPR. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Let's get back to our interview with Ray Shonky, the former lineman with the then Washington's Redskins. He was being brutally honest about playing with pain and about the drugs supplied before the players went on the field and then the drugs to help them sleep at night. I was in the audience when Shonky gave a talk last week about his new book, Fat Girl Sings. Let's hear more of our conversation with him.
I tell you, when I would take enough so I could sleep after the game. But the day I retired, I went into my bathroom with a jar full of these amphetamines and flushed them down the toilet.
Well, you know, that night in the audience was a young man, you know, and I saw him as a future athlete out there on the field. And he was just so transfixed with every word in your talk that night. And, you know, you were able to use the lessons that you learned playing pro ball, and you parlayed that into a successful career once you left football. It was just fascinating to me to just to watch his face and his expressions as he listened to you.
Well, you know, it's a short-lived business. You know, the future is very limited. The average career is only 3 years, and most the chances of making it in the pro highly, highly unusual coming out of college. And then when you finally get there, the career is very short. So it's you're really risking a lot to put all your eggs in that basket. But you have to put a tremendous amount of dedication, otherwise you'd never make it. And then, of course, you try to figure out how am I going to stay in this business, you know. And then the fear is because the money's so good that you need to play because you don't have another source of income. So a lot of players don't prepare. They don't prepare or won't prepare for life after. And subsequently, it's a very huge drop in both, you know, money-wise, physical-wise, and mental. You know, it becomes very sad for a lot of players.
Well, the football dream is out there for so many young people. You know, we heard from Marcus Mariota. He marks 10 years since, you know, he went pro. And it's just stunning to think that a whole decade has gone by. And yet he's been such a positive role model. You know, he's back here at home, you know, helping young athletes this week as we talk. And so it's great that we have these role models who have come out on the other side after the game has maybe, you know, chewed you up and spit you out. But I think it's so important so people understand, you know, what's involved in the sport.
I think it's a wonderful goal to have in life. It was a huge accomplishment because the odds are of making it into the pros are very, very slim. And then to stay in the business a long time is also incredibly low. But you have to prepare yourself. You have to prepare yourself for the time when it's no longer you're able to play. And that's the downer, is that the players, when they leave the game, so many of them are bankrupt, don't have any way to make an ongoing living, that are basically living out because the income is so high and they live beyond their means. They haven't prepared themselves. And that's the sad part. I was lucky because I got hurt and it was cut early, so I knew it could end. And I knew that I had to get ready for that time. And people on my day off, I would work. And the guys on the team would say, "Why are you working so hard all the time?" I said, "Because one day it's going to be over. And I want to be ready for it." And if you do the same, and they'll say, "Hey, you know, I got to do that." But I worked, I'm building my business. I had a luncheon that I had that I put on with, and I gave all the money that I had out of the luncheon. I have anywhere from 100 to 300 people come and listen to updates on the game, and I have the players, and I'd give the money to the players. I wouldn't take any money, but what I would take is the names of all the business owners and their addresses and their phone numbers, so I could call them. And I was building my business while I was playing.
Smart.
So when I finally retired, I was making twice as much money that in my business that I was football, and I had deferred 5 paychecks. So 5 annual checks, I finally told the treasurer and finance guy, I said, "I don't want my checks this year." And finally, after 5 years, he said, "When are you going to come and get your money?" And this is a bad move by me. I didn't ask for an interest on that money. Anyway, I had a tremendous savings account for myself, and I had plenty of time in which to really build my business. But my business was already successful, so I could really... It just took off. But I had, I had learned my lesson early because I'd been on 3 teams in a couple of years, and I knew you couldn't count on it. So when I got to the Redskins, I played 10 years there, even though there was some permanency. It still was a very precarious occupation.
You had not only the skills but the smarts to see what this business was all about, you know, early on. It's an interesting book, and you hope that those young players out there will pick it up and learn some lessons too as they chase their dreams.
Yeah, and I hope that, you know, I think you should always chase your dreams, but also be prepared for the downside. You don't want to chase a dream so that your downside is nothing. There's nothing there to fall back on. And fall back on your education, fall back on other opportunities. If the goal that you're chasing is like pro football, the odds of making it are very low. The odds of a long career are, again, highly limited. So you need to prepare, you know, and then you need to look at whatever that goal or opportunity. And so I think it's wonderful. I think it was certainly a very important part of my life. I learned so many lessons. I was able to build a financial base and then leverage that into something that's bigger and stronger and better. And so I have good feelings about it, but I also know the downside.
Well, this has really been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for being willing to share your story.
Thank you very much for permitting me to be with you.
That was former pro football lineman Ray Shonkey, who talked with us this morning about how he was able to turn lessons learned in a sport he loved to a successful business career. His book, Fat Girl Sings, Discovering, Embracing, and Leveraging Racial Identity on the Football Field in Business and in Life. It's available online at all major booksellers. That does it for us today. Tomorrow, a new development in the climate lawsuit against oil companies. Give us feedback by calling our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find the conversation as a podcast on our website or on Spotify, Apple, or Google. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.